You are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting today from the Sea Ranch, California, where it's been a spectacular day. It's July 19, 2015, and today I'll be talking to you about prolactinomas. These are tumors of the lactotroph or prolactin-producing cells of the pituitary gland.
These tumors account for about 40% of all pituitary adenomas.
Many of them are undetected during life. For example, one study showed that about 27% of all persons who have an autopsy have a small pituitary adenoma, and about 40% of those were prolactinomas. However, they're not that clinically apparent. It's estimated that only about 18 per 100,000 persons develop a clinically apparent pituitary tumor. So many prolactinomas are undiagnosed, and these are probably people who have had erectile dysfunction or irregular menses throughout life. Physicians blow it off, don't pay attention, patient goes undiagnosed.
These tumors come in different sizes. Those that are microadenomas are less than a centimeter in size. Macroadenomas are greater than a centimeter in size. And we refer to a tumor as a giant tumor or an invasive tumor if it's greater than 4 centimeters and invades local structures, respectively.
Obviously, all macroadenomas were once microadenomas, but we're not entirely sure what causes the tumor to become large in the first place. There are probably mutations that are acquired in some of the genes regulating the cell cycle that lead to that transition. It's been estimated that only about 7% of microadenomas will increase in size over time. The truth of the matter is we really don't know, and I certainly wouldn't take my chances if I had a microprolactinoma. I've seen plenty of folks who have a microadenoma at one point early in their life, and maybe it led to infertility or whatever, and they were treated with bromocriptine, and then they pretty much lose contact with medical health care in regards to that tumor and show up in their 50s or even 60s with a very large invasive prolactinoma. So think of all of these as potential for significant growth. And prolactinomas also come in several flavors. We have the pure prolactinoma that just produces prolactin. Some of them are mixed tumors that produce growth hormone and TSH as well. The most common one is called a somatomammatroph adenoma. That's a tumor of a cell that's a little bit less differentiated or more primitive than the prolactin cell, and it has the ability to produce growth hormone and prolactin.
And even more primitive is the acidophil stem cell adenoma, which is a tumor from the acidophil stem cells, which become the mammosomatotroph cells and then split off into the prolactin and the growth hormone-producing cells. I mention these tumors because you may see the names on your pathology reports at some point.
In the last podcast on hyperprolactinemia, I talked a little bit about prolactin levels in patients with prolactinomas. And in general, keep in mind that a microprolactinoma can have any degree of hyperprolactinemia, as can the somatomammatroph and acidophil stem cell adenomas. If it's a pure macroprolactinoma, usually those prolactin levels are greater than 200, and the highest I've ever seen is 20,000.
It's long been thought that there's a correlation between tumor size and a degree of hyperprolactinemia, and I would say that I've seen enough patients to not believe in that correlation. I've seen some patients with very large tumors who have only very mild elevations in prolactin, and patients with small tumors who've had astronomical elevations in prolactin. So maybe there's a little bit of a weak correlation, but tumor size and degree of hyperprolactinemia don't always correlate in my clinical practice and experience.
I'm often asked what causes these tumors, and to be truthful, we don't know. All endocrine glands form tumors, and we don't really understand what regulates the growth of the cells that leads to tumors in patients with endocrine glands. We do know that some patients with hyperprolactinemia and prolactinomas have multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1, and prolactinoma is one of the original components of that syndrome. Other patients have AIP gene mutations, and then there are probably other familial situations as well. There's a lot of controversy over whether estrogens can cause pituitary tumor formation, especially prolactinomas. And while some tumors develop during pregnancy and others are diagnosed after a period of oral contraceptives, and there's a rare case report of people taking diethylstilbestrol or of a female-to-male transgender developing a pituitary tumor, we usually don't think of estrogens as causal. They may be
somehow involved in the promotion of tumorigenesis, but it may be that you have to have some other hit, if you will, to develop a tumor in response to estrogen administration.
Okay, let's talk about clinical presentation. Well, first, some patients are diagnosed incidentally. They hit their head, they get a scan, they have a tumor, they're evaluated and found to have a prolactinoma. We see that all the time.
More commonly, however, someone presents with symptoms or signs related to the tumor, and they may be in those patients who have large tumors, mass effects such as headache or visual compromise by the tumor pressing on the undersurface of the visual pathways, or sinus congestion, rarely a nosebleed, for example. But more often, they present because of the effects of prolactin on hormonal systems. Prolactin itself stimulates lactation, and you can see galactorrhea or presence of breast milk in women and also in men, depending on the degree of the hyperprolactinemia.
And galactorrhea truly is any breast discharge whatsoever, whether it be oily and clear or look like actual milk.
One thing to keep in mind is that galactorrhea is not always due to prolactinoma. In fact, it's only due to prolactinoma about 40% of the time. The other cases are usually women who have previously breastfed and might have lingering galactorrhea or a hormonal change in life that can lead to breast milk production. Perhaps a woman has taken oral contraceptives, for example, in the past as well. But keep in mind that just because one has galactorrhea doesn't mean there's a prolactinoma. It could simply be the breast increased tissue sensitivity to normal levels of prolactin, accounting for the explanation of galactorrhea in women who do not have prolactinomas.
Now, prolactin interferes with the cyclic pulsatility of the gonadotropin-releasing hormone-secreting neurons in the hypothalamus. These neurons secrete GnRH, which affects LH and FSH secretion in a coordinated fashion, and you have to have coordinated LH and FSH secretion to be able to have normal function of the ovaries and the testicles. So when you have hyperprolactinemia, you basically have
a shutdown of the hypothalamic processes regulating those pituitary functions that in turn regulate gonadal function in women and men. In women, you can see anything from the spectrum of infertility to irregular menses to lack of menses and all of the attendant symptoms of a low estrogen, such as hot flashes and flushes, vaginal dryness, dyspareunia, etc. In men, we see infertility, diminished libido, diminished sex drive, if they'll mention it or complain about it. Most men are usually stoked and won't mention it, even though it's a real problem. But all the usual things that are associated with testosterone deficiency, including depression, loss of muscle mass, night sweats, etc.
A diagnosis of hyperprolactinemia is secured by finding an elevated prolactin and a pituitary tumor, with the caveat that some non-functioning tumors will cause stalk effect and some other lesions of the cella aren't representative tumors but might actually cause hyperprolactinemia. Pathology is the only definitive way to get the diagnosis, having a surgeon take the tumor out and a pathologist look at it, doing immunochemistry for prolactin. That's really the only true way to know whether you would definitely have a prolactinoma. Treatment options are expansive and should be individualized according to the patient, the time of life, the goals of treatment, etc. In general, those patients who are not interested in fertility, who have microadenomas, could be treated with birth control pills and have their tumor followed. I tend not to recommend that, but it's in the literature, and I have a patient who wants to do that. That's fine.
Elderly patients with small tumors may not necessarily need to be treated as long as they're going to be followed up closely.
I think the one thing that guides treatment for most physicians is that study after study after study shows that in patients with various disease processes who are asked to follow up, many times patients are ultimately lost to follow up and they don't come back. And we worry about those folks because their tumors will probably or may progress over time and can potentially lead to significant morbidity that could be prevented by careful and close follow-up. So generally, as physicians, we tend to recommend definitive treatment rather than follow-up.
definitive treatment comes in two flavors. First, there's treatment with dopamine agonist drugs, and then also surgery. I'll talk about surgery first because dopamine agonist drugs requires more time, and I want to conclude with a couple of things that are related to treatment with dopamine agonist drugs.
Frankly, I think the most important thing to consider when considering surgery is whether the surgeon is excellent. And I think that if you're going to have surgery for prolactinoma, it needs to be a top-tier neurosurgeon operating on your pituitary gland because you want a cure with minimal morbidity and zero mortality. And you need to seek out a competent surgeon at a
pituitary center of excellence if you choose to have surgery, just so that you can get the best outcomes.
Patients with microadenomas that are isolated and not invasive have about a 90 to 95% cure rate at surgery. And we operate on those patients who want to have a chance at cure and do not want to take lifelong medications.
It's a little more difficult when it comes to macroadenomas. Our favorite approach for macroadenomas is to operate on those patients who have failure of successful treatment with dopamine agonist drugs, even if their prolactin goes down but their tumor grows or does not regress on medical therapy, those patients are candidates for surgery. Some patients we find that it's easier to treat them medically if we debulk their tumor, and certainly if we see a large cystic component to their tumor. While some of those cysts may get smaller with medical treatment, debulking seems to be the best approach to resolve any visual field deficits that may have occurred as a result of the tumor. The intracellular macroadenomas that are about a centimeter, centimeter and a half in size that are not invasive, we treat as a microadenoma because at our institution we can usually render those patients disease-free.
Now, medical therapy with dopamine agonists. Dopamine agonists are drugs that are like dopamine, and if you remember from the last podcast, dopamine inhibits prolactin production by pituitary cells. And
most but not all prolactinomas have dopamine receptors on the cell surface membranes. Some vary in density or amount of receptors on those surfaces, and it's believed that cells that have low numbers of receptors are the ones that aren't likely to respond to dopamine agonist drugs. There are two drugs that we use to treat prolactinomas. The first one, bromocriptine, has been around for probably 30, 40 years now, and cabergoline for about 20 years in the United States, longer in Europe.
On balance, most studies have showed that cabergoline is going to last longer, be more effective, be better tolerated, and if you look at the economic cost of treatment, you get a better response for every dollar spent when you use cabergoline rather than bromocriptine. Furthermore, bromocriptine has to be taken several times daily to be maximally effective, whereas cabergoline is taken once or twice a week, and thus compliance is better.
In my practice, I use bromocriptine only if insurance dictates such, and usually I find that patients need 2.5 milligrams 2 to 3 times daily, with maximal doses being 15 milligrams daily in divided doses. I don't believe that once-a-day treatment is very effective for patients who have prolactinomas, and especially those with macroprolactinomas. Cabergoline is usually started at 0.25 milligram once weekly, and the dose goes up to twice weekly or even three times weekly or every other day, with the most I've ever used being 1.5 milligrams every other day. I usually start treatment and reassess prolactin levels in 6 to 8 weeks and then alter the dose in a stepwise fashion to find the least amount of medication necessary to achieve the goal of treatment. That means prolactin levels checked at 6 week intervals until we achieve a final dose. Once we achieve a dose that reaches maximum normalization of prolactin or maximum likelihood of normalizing prolactin, I usually wait 3 to 6 months to repeat an MRI to see whether the tumor has regressed. Importantly, some patients with macroadenomas may take a year or a year and a half for their tumors to fully regress. Some patients, however, have immediate responses, and I've had patients who've had visual compromise start treatment on a Friday, call the office on Monday saying their vision had entirely cleared, and that's likely due to some immediate tumor regression. Now, the data are all over the place, but it's said that about 95% of patients with microprolactinomas normalize prolactin, With macroadenomas, it's said that you get 90% reduction of prolactin in a majority of people. About 67% of patients will have more than 50% of tumor regression. Probably 20 to 30% of patients, their tumors literally melt away. And about 10% of patients will have really no demonstrable tumor regression whatsoever when it comes to macroadenomas. Interestingly, microadenomas tend not to regress in size very much with treatment. So the biggest gains as far as tumor size reductions are seen in those patients who have macroadenomas. As expected, we see a fair degree of visual compromise resolution in those patients that have visual field abnormalities. Menses usually return, fertility returns. Women need to be careful there because they might get pregnant fairly soon after starting treatment. And gonadal function usually improves in men. Galactorrhea usually resolves in about 9% of patients. As I mentioned before, those patients who don't meet some of these treatment goals usually go to surgery if they've tried medication first. In regards to cabergoline, studies have showed the side effect rate is about 40%, but the drug discontinuance rate is only about 3%, meaning that most people ultimately get used to the side effects or they improve over time. So I encourage people to power through those side effects they may be having of these drugs. Not everyone can do that, however, and that's when we would consider surgery in some of those patients who are intolerant to the medication. Some of the side effects include nausea, vomiting, headache, dizziness, especially upon standing in the morning. I've had patients who have had, I don't really want to call them psychotic thoughts or anything like that, but sort of out-of-body experiences and auditory and or visual hallucinations as a consequence of therapy. I've seen one patient with vasculitis and a couple of people who had movement disorders, some others who've had chronic fatigue in response to treatment. Most of the side effects mentioned do go away with time, and they can be minimized by taking the drug at bedtime with a snack. One of the very interesting things about these drugs is that in very high doses, they activate the serotonin receptors. Patients who've been treated with high doses of cabergoline, for example, include those patients with Parkinson's disease who get anywhere from 10 to 40 times the daily dose that we would treat a patient with a pituitary tumor, and those patients have developed thickening of the heart valves and some heart valve insufficiency, and that's due to activation of the serotonin receptor, which causes fibroelastosis of the valves and the cords that hold the heart valves to the heart muscle. Studies have looked at this issue in patients with pituitary tumors. I've even published in this arena, and we don't believe that there's a problem in patients who take the drug for pituitary tumors because the dose is much lower. What's going to be interesting to see is whether over a lifetime of taking this medication there's a problem, because it may be one of those things that's not only related to dose but also duration of therapy. But so far in 20 years, I haven't seen anybody having heart problems in response to this drug. The areas where I would be careful is if a patient did come to me and said they had valvular heart disease, I would follow echocardiograms. And in those patients with acromegaly who are also treated with this drug who can have a cardiomyopathy, I would certainly follow the echocardiograms in those patients as well. But generally speaking, about 7 or 8 years ago, I stopped doing routine echocardiograms in all patients treated with these drugs. Now, obviously, some women are interested in having children and they harbor a prolactinoma. Maybe a lady presenting with infertility, found to have the prolactinoma, wants to get it treated so she can bear a child. The thing that I tell patients is that studies have been done and showed that about 5% of microadenomas will grow and cause problems during pregnancy. Probably 15% of the tumors increase in size, but only about 5% of patients will have a problem such as headache or loss of some other pituitary hormone. About 30% of the patients with macroadenomas have tumors that increase in size, and about 15% of those get into trouble. The biggest concern I have is the development of hypopituitarism, especially because a patient might be hypopituitary during the stress of labor and needs steroid supplementation. Most studies that have been evaluated suggest that you can discontinue the medication during pregnancy and follow the patient looking at visual fields, symptoms and signs of headaches or visual loss, for example. I also follow prolactin levels because we can compare the rise in prolactin to what is expected during a normal pregnancy and know whether there has been tumor growth and decide on an MRI, and if there has been growth, then decide to start back on the medication. This drug has never been studied in pregnancy in a clinical trial, but there have been thousands of pregnancies reported where women had taken one of these two drugs during their pregnancy, and there's no increased risk of birth defects, pregnancy loss, learning disabilities in the offspring, etc. So generally speaking, we believe them to be safe in pregnancy. We must, however, advise all patients to stop the drug, and then we start it when necessary after considerable discussion. If there is a problem during the pregnancy in response to the estrogens causing tumor growth, for example, that needs attention. So I'd like to conclude by saying that the most important thing that you, the patient, can do with your prolactinoma is to get medical care. And if you decide not to undergo any particular interventions, make sure that you have a plan of follow-up so that you can treat this tumor at the earliest possible moment it starts to cause trouble. For patients who've had surgery and have been rendered disease-free, we usually recommend prolactin determinations at six-month intervals for 2 to 3 years and then annually thereafter. And for a patient who decides to not undergo treatment for a prolactinoma, clearly, I think they should be followed at probably the same intervals, and in those who have tumors and are on treatment, probably at least once or twice a year with your physician. If you've had your disease more than 5 years and you've done well, probably annual follow-up would be all that's required. Usually, in regards to follow-up MRI studies, we recommend those only if we see a problem or a change in the prolactin level. However, I've seen a couple prolactinomas that did increase in size despite the fact the prolactin level was controlled, so it's probably worth getting an MRI every 3 to 5 years, even if you have stable treated disease. All right, so that's it on prolactinomas. Feel free to send us any questions you may have, and we can certainly address those later when we do the Ask Us podcast in the future. And wish you all a good day, and thanks for listening. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News. Take care.